Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Auxlit podcast. Joining me today, we have Rana Mittal on the topic of China and the world. Rana is a celebrated British historian, currently professor of the history of modern China at Oxford, but will shortly become Astley Professor of US-Asia Relations at Harvard Kennedy School. He is a published author and a regular presenter for BBC Radio 3. In this episode, he will be sharing his view on how China's relationship with and effect on the rest of the world is likely to change, drawing on his years of experience in academic research in the field. So hello, Rana.
Hello, Wanlin. It's very nice to be here on the Oxford podcast. And yep, I think your summary was exactly right. I've been studying Chinese history and Chinese politics for many decades now. I've had the fascination of seeing China come from a place that was not very well known to the wider world when I started as a student more than 30 years ago, to being now, of course, second biggest economy, second biggest military, and one of the major geopolitical actors in the world. So it's been quite a ride for China, and I've enjoyed being in the slipstream as I watch and comment on it.
Yeah, it's incredible to have you joining us here today with so many years of experience and, of course, accolades under your belt.
Well, so you make me sound very old now, Wanlin.
that was not my intention.
No, that's fine. We're all getting old all the time, except you, I'm sure. But anyway, let's carry on and talk, of course.
Of course, yeah. So today, the structure of our podcast, we'll firstly be discussing a little bit about your views, maybe starting with isolationism. We read your Guardian article about Xi Jinping being seduced by a vision of greater isolation for China. If you could explain a little bit about what that main argument is.
Well, I'd very much like to do that one, Lin, because that article I wrote, which people can find online on the Guardian website for free, is a very good example of why, if you are a historian like me, you should really stick to talking about the past and not try and predict the future. Because what it shows is that even with the knowledge of the past, you can get things very wrong. And what I will say about this article is that there's two things about it. One is that one element of it is completely and utterly wrong, but I still, which is the second thing, but I still stand by it completely, and I'll explain why. Mm-hmm. So when I wrote that article, it was September of last year, 2022. And at that point, you might remember, we still didn't know what was happening with COVID in China. At least we knew it was still going on. We knew that the lockdowns were very, very harsh, that if any outbreak of COVID happened anywhere really within the borders of China, there would be a complete shutdown of the area. And at that point, most of us, including I think in China, thought that that was going to carry on for a long time. I do remember speaking to friends, you know, academics, business people, saying that they expected to be essentially stuck in that COVID world for maybe a year, 2 years or more in China. Mm-hmm. Now, we now know that that didn't happen. In fact, for a variety of reasons, but mainly medical reasons, the policy was changed in November, December of last year, 2022. A lot of people noticed the almost unprecedented big street demonstrations and online demonstrations protesting against the COVID rules. And they had some effect, I think, in changing the policy. But that wasn't the main reason. Most epidemiologists now look at what was happening with the Omicron variant of COVID in China at that time, and saw that really it couldn't be held back. Even lockdowns wouldn't prevent it from spreading. So the authorities clearly embraced the inevitable, switched policies completely, just opened everything up. And now China is essentially back to being a place where COVID regulations have no real significance. Yeah. So in my piece, I worked on the assumption that China will be isolated for quite a long time. And that was completely wrong. But the underlying thesis, the argument I wanted to make, I'd still stick to it. And this is what it was. I argued that in some strange ways, being held back because of COVID was helping the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, and its leadership to achieve a goal which I think that they are quite keen to pursue, which is the idea that the outside world is dangerous. The United States, in particular, in their view, is looking to basically hold China back, and that the best thing that China can do in this model is to basically have very, very strong borders and not too much penetration between from the outside into China itself. And the COVID regulations provided a, you know, cast iron health-driven reason as to why interaction between China and the world might become much more difficult. You could always say, well, you know, basically it's to prevent disease. Now, that, of course, changed with the ending of the COVID regulations. But the basic sense of where China is going, the idea amongst the leadership that on the one hand, China is a growing power that will have ever more influence in the world. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the idea that actually maybe China will do best if it's not too connected to the outside world in terms of vulnerability, that is something that I think still continues very strongly. It was strengthened as a feeling by the COVID period, but it still carries on right now. So examples of that would be, for instance, that China's own stated economic policy, the so-called dual circulation economic policy, makes the startling proposition that China will increase its global trade surplus with the rest of the world while reducing its level of imports from the outside world. In other words, maximizing China's self-sufficiency at home, but also trying to make sure that the rest of the world has to rely on supply chains that come through China or end up in China or start from China. So that sense of China looking to isolate itself, I think, is real, but it's a different, it's a very kind of 21st century sort of isolation, because it doesn't mean like becoming like, well, North Korea is the best example of a country that really does shut itself from the outside world. Today, isolation doesn't mean you can't visit China. Of course, these days, it's now possible to go into China again from the outside world, no problem. It doesn't mean cutting off from trade routes around the world. That's still going on as well, of course. But it does mean pushing back much more on the idea that China, or rather strengthening the idea that China has to maintain its own systems of economic and political capacity and production with as little interference from the outside world as is reasonably possible. And that is very much the political goal that I think has become strengthened during the last few COVID years.
If I may jump in here, yeah, that's a very, I think, succinct and great summary of your article, as well as your corrections to it in light of the new policies. I think in the article, you described this sort of tension between the isolation as well as the drive to expand China's influence in the world. So you also mentioned dual circulation just now, China's wanting to increase trade surplus with the wider world while simultaneously becoming more dependent on its domestic economy. How do you think China is able to mitigate this sort of tension? Because we do see, you know, striking back. Like, we see the US trade war being an example of other countries not being very happy with this kind of oxymoron policy going on.
Sure. So I think, Wanlin, you put your finger, and I haven't asked what you're studying here at Oxford, but is it PPE?
It is
politics, politics, philosophy, and economics, for those who don't, or philosophy, politics, and economics, I should say. Philosophy comes first in the title. So for those listening who are not Oxford students, this is a pretty iconic degree here at Oxford, which is used to try and train people in the ways of the world, how politics works, and then philosophy to help them kind of understand the significance of it, and then economics so they can do the numbers. Now, I think we need some more PPE graduates like you, Wanlin, working in the Chinese government. Why? Because you have identified a fundamental, well, there's a great word in Chinese, you'll know it, I'm sure, maodun, meaning contradiction. And although it's a word that has a much longer history, it's not a modern word. It comes actually from an old Chinese folktale. It's used to translate the Marxist concept of contradiction, where two different things come together and kind of have to struggle with each other to reach a conclusion. And in this case, there's a lot of struggling to be done, because the central tenets of the dual circulation, as it's called, economic policy, demand the following three things. Number one, that China should increase its trade surplus with the rest of the world. Number two, that it's going to increase the level of domestic consumption as a driver of growth, particularly by unleashing spending. And number three, that China's going to keep its capital account closed and not move towards basically being fully present in the international, fully traded money markets. Now, good PPE grads will point out that these three policies are incompatible with each other if you want to do them all at the same time. You can do two out of three, but you can't do three out of three. So what's going to happen? Well, my guess is that what will happen is what is happening and has happened before, which is, of those three things, number two, domestic consumption, will be squeezed. Look at the figures coming out of China today. Yes, consumption levels are up, but that's because they're being compared year on year with COVID. I have to remember, it was less than a year, more than 6 months, but less than a year that full COVID restrictions were still operating in China. It's only just over a year ago, spring, that Shanghai, you know, one of the world's biggest commercial cities, was locked down for 7 weeks. And that really put a massive hatchet through consumption, because you can't go outside. You can consume from your desktop or your phone, but you can't really do it in the same way as if you're wandering around. So it's not surprising that initial domestic consumption growth in China has been higher than it was. But that can't continue year on year, at least not in that form, because you can't keep abolishing COVID every year. So those elements essentially point to a bigger fundamental problem, which is not that China doesn't have the economic capacity to grow, it does. But to do so, it has to take certain sorts of political decisions that are harder to manage at the moment. Let's take, let's go back to that point about consumption. Why aren't Chinese people consuming more overall? Well, there are several reasons. Number one is that for a lot of Chinese people, property has been a really important investment, particularly as individual homeowners, for the last 25, 30 years. Weirdly enough, maybe not explicitly, but this is a policy that would have inspired, taken inspiration from Margaret Thatcher, the British politician, who, of course, tried to make sure that everyone in Britain would buy their own home. And China was the country that actually did it. More than 90% home ownership in China, it's big. But the thing is that owning a home in China, like anywhere else, is not cheap. You have to pay mortgage payments. You basically have to take a lot of your disposable income out of the kind of disposable income stream. And then beyond that, there's a whole bunch of other things that cost a lot of money in China. So if you're living in a socialist country, as some people say, like the United Kingdom, big capitalist socialist country, your healthcare is free, at least if you go to the hospital. But of course, in China, the system is hybrid. There is a certain amount of free healthcare, but actually, in many other areas, you're paying insurance, so you have to pay that into the system. So a bit like America, healthcare costs actually take quite a lot out of the spending capacity of the country. What else? Well, okay, education. It has until till about 7 years ago, 2015, China maintained the one-child policy. There were lots of exceptions, there always were, but basically, China became a one-child family policy country. And when you have one child, you want to invest in the child in all sorts of ways, including things like education spending, which became very expensive, not least in areas which, until the government cracked down on it, the online tutoring universe, which is very expensive and very extensive. All of these things suck up disposable income. They don't really feed consumption in the way that most models of economies that create a sort of just domestic consuming middle class really do. Now, because China's huge, and because it has a massive internal market, and because it did actually take some really very serious and important reforms that have increased the capacity of people to spend. So I'm thinking of things like the investment in technology, which means that China now has a really very, very smooth cashless payment system operating on a massive market basis across the country. All of these things provide, basically the reduced, well, you're a PPE graduate, Wanli, that reduces friction, economic friction, in other words. So there's all sorts of reasons why the figures are much better than they might have been in a country that had done nothing in that area. But it doesn't solve the basic problem. There are still too many barriers, including caution about healthcare, pensions, and so forth, to have people really unleash their savings. And people save a lot in China, and a great deal of what disposable income there is has to go into spending in areas that can't be bypassed, like mortgages, healthcare, and so forth. So that's the dilemma, really. There is an economic problem in China, to which the answer at the moment is more an answer of political sloganeering almost. Growth, growth, growth. I mean, China's not the only place that did that. Liz Truss, during the brief time that she was British Prime Minister, talked growth, growth, growth as well. And her experiment was rather short-lived. But in China, it's been going on for longer. But simply talking about growth isn't enough. You have to provide the circumstances in which that growth can emerge. Some of them are there in China, so let's not exaggerate. But at the same level, the dual circulation policy at the moment contains a fundamental maodun, a contradiction that means that China is going to have to choose or be explicit about which of its three economic goals it wants to put forward. Right now, it appears to be that consumption is taking the hit. And at the moment, I don't see a shift in that policy.
Okay, so it does sound like China will not be able to last long if it continues to insist on consumption, or rather, this particular priority is not going to last long. So, what do you think is China relying on alternatively, other than domestic consumption, to drive growth at the moment?
Oh, yes. Well, the answer to that question is essentially surrounding us right now, Wanlin, and that is technology. the new forms of technology. So let me give you a sketch of what I think is going on. I do not hang out in policymaking circles in China. So anyone who does, please come in on the podcast and tell us what's really going on. But I think the answer is something like this. Right now, there is a stalling of growth in a whole variety of areas in China. It's causing all sorts of really major short-term problems. Youth unemployment, particularly in cities, now running in many cases at 20%. You know, one out of every five younger people, not just actually not able to find jobs, but in some cases getting university degrees, but then not getting the kind of jobs that they would expect, having sacrificed both, you know, intellectually and financially to get those degrees. And you've probably seen on Chinese social media, certainly I have, you know, these, you know, things that people are stuck up on Weibo and Bilibili and elsewhere, just saying, you know, I got my degree now, you know, what's this for? There was a book published actually maybe 10, 15 years ago, before your generation, I think, called Bie Beida Deng Yuling, graduating from Peking University counts for zero. But that was a different thing, because that was at a time when actually the economy was buoyant. And what the guy who wrote that was saying was like, don't waste your time studying all this stuff. You should just go and xiahai, jump into the sea of business, you know, be an entrepreneur. Don't worry about book learning. Now it's very different. People are saying, okay, they're graduating from Peking, maybe not Peking University. I think job prospects there are still pretty good, but a lot of universities, and it doesn't count for anything because people say, well, you have this piece of paper, but we don't have a job for you. So that's a problem. Then let's think about the bit of China that people don't think about enough, and that is rural China. About half the population of China is still living in what's called the countryside. I say what's called the countryside because, as you'll know, Chinese land law is a little bit flexible. And depending on what a local government wants to do and it wants to sell land, it often redefines what is urban land and what is rural land. Because a lot of the thing that brings in money for local governments, which is another area of real concern for the Chinese government, has to do with how you can actually get cash to pay for stuff. I'm going on a slight sideline here, but I think it's really important because for those listening who don't know China and sometimes think of it as like there's a black box and China is this place where there's like three guys in Beijing and they control everything. No, actually, it's a really, really complicated place with a lot of things happening at the grassroots that need to be understood. Just on a local government question, unlike a lot of local governments in countries with freer capital markets, Chinese local governments can't simply borrow. They sometimes get credit brought to them by the central government, they have to pay it back, which is why local government debt is a really important and dangerous area in terms of a lot of people, in terms of a lot of local governments in China. But also things like COVID. Well, who was paying for all the kind of tests on COVID and the PPE and the, you know, dabai, the big whites, they're calling the kind of big guys wearing plastic sheets who go and take you away to the isolation area. Well, these things cost money. They don't do this stuff for free. And who's paying? Local governments. So again, you have all of these places that are sucking money out of the system, and they're desperately trying to find places to do it. So selling land is sometimes a way to do that. So going back to rural China, so what's the bigger issue there? Well, basically, human capital. In other words, one of the most important things, because your question, I have remember what the question is how's China going to get out of this economic slump? Well, it's not a slump, but you know, it's a slowdown. Okay, so basically, rural China has horrible, horrible numbers when it comes to educational improvement levels. China's cities going through the roof, particularly Shanghai, you know, Chongqing, big cities, people, you know, kids learning math, kids learning all sorts of technology and other things. It's going really well. There's money, there's investment, there's technology there for them. In the rural areas, not so. Lots of kids are basically being looked after by grandparents or by kind of local government run boarding schools. And for British listeners, I'm not talking like Eton or Westminster here. I'm talking about something, you know, really you would not want to send your kids to, because the parents are off in the cities earning money, building their skyscrapers, building the highways, building the railway, high speed, the Galtier, the, you know, the high speed rail stations, sending money back to the countryside, but they're not there. So the schools have to take up a lot, and the schools aren't getting properly funded. Again, back to that local government problem again. But also, parents have to pay fees. They're not free after a certain point, I think after the age of 12, I want to say, but, you know, about that sort of age. And beyond that, the question of what people are actually learning, you know, in the countryside, the level of enhancement of the actual knowledge base is just much lower. And of course, unlike any other large middle-income country, people can't move freely from one place to another. So in other words, there's parents who are going off to build in the cities. Then it's not illegal. I mean, clearly China wouldn't get built if it weren't for large amounts of migrant labor, but they don't carry all their welfare rights with them. And that's why the kids have to stay back at home. So solving that problem of how this huge underpowering of China's youth in the countryside is dealt with is one of those understated problems that's really going to come to the fore in the 2030s if it isn't solved now. Now, the government does have ideas. They talk about, the Xinnongcun, the kind of new rural villages, and how these will be improved. But it doesn't add up to a full policy yet, partly because there's a kind of, again, it's a maodun, it's a contradiction. They want China to urbanize. You can understand why. Cities tend to have more incomes, they feel more modern. In the countryside, people are going to big scale agriculture anyway. Then, the small plots that Chairman Mao was encouraging people to have back in the 50s, that's not really a thing anymore. But at the same time, they're not going to do it overnight. And right now, they still need to come up with an answer for people who live in the countryside now as to what they and their children's prospects are today, in 2 years, in 5 years. Because it's no good saying it's going to be all wonderful in the year 2049 if you're wondering about basically how you're going to make a living in 2024. So just a last note on the back of that. So part of the answer, both in the city and the countryside, I think is technology. And I think it would say that the obsession that the Chinese state has about trying to build up the technology sector is partly about the things that the rest of the world worries about, like, is China going to build artificial intelligence so that it can produce military drones that can basically, fly across the South China Sea? Well, yeah, probably is the answer to that. But beyond that, there's also a huge use of that technology to try and change the labor market. For instance, the idea of working from home, which of course in gender terms is very important. One of the main problems, and again, you may know about this one, Lin, is that the even now the professional labor market in China is very biased towards male workers, and young professional women often find that not only are terms and conditions not the same for them, but essentially the pressure, the dual pressure from the state to get married, to have children, to increase the population size, but also to become autonomous earners in their own right, is simply intolerable in many cases. And in the last resort, lots of young women end up, not choosing to get married. Now, the argument the state is making is that changing the gendered labor market through technology might be part of the answer to that. And by bringing more women into the workforce over time, you increase growth. But I have to say that these are all dice that are being cast on the table. None of these is a dead cert. They all depend on a lot of things coming right, and they depend on stability and predictability in the labor market and the financial markets in China. Some of that is up to the rest of the world, but some of it is also up to the decisions that China's own politicians make. And that is where some of the greatest tensions are likely to emerge in the near future.
So would you say tapping into these underutilized segments of the labor market would, or effectively doing so, would adequately address the slowing growth problem? Or is there other things that China needs to do, such as becoming more open and not only relying on the domestic economy?
I think there's a lot of things that have to come together, but let's take it from first principles, Wan Lin. I would say that the most important thing in terms of boosting China's growth is that there has to be reliability and predictability in terms of not only China's economic situation, but its situation in terms of its connections to the region, Asia Pacific region, and beyond. And the flip side of that is saying that anything such as a confrontation or a conflict that could disrupt that peace and stability will have all sorts of human costs, but it will also be economically very, very damaging. It will be very damaging to the wider world as well, but it would be very damaging for China. So in those terms, I mean, when I was talking to you about what the issues that are currently need to be dealt with in Chinese policy terms are, I concentrated very, very much on the domestic side of things. And that wasn't accidental, because I think it's always worth noting that there are, 17 things, I probably named most of them, that China really, really needs to kind of get right in the next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, to have a decent chance of encouraging growth and moving it forward. And I would say that in answer to your question, yes, it's absolutely possible. You need to do various things, including a proper energy transition. There is move towards post-fossil fuel green growth in China, including a lot of concentration on solar, but there needs to be much more than there is now. But you can see the signs of how that might come about. But I would say that one of the greatest dangers would be essentially if there ends up being a confrontation, possibly with the United States, possibly with some other actor, that essentially disrupts the economy of the entire region. So that is the most important thing for China to avoid if it's serious about actually taking that growth in a sustainable direction.
In light of that, why would China be moving forward with, you know, what people have termed the wolf warrior diplomacy or the major country diplomacy, where it seems that China's projecting a much more aggressive and assertive image on the world stage?
So many people will know, but just to explain, the term wolf warrior. So this is based on a movie, Janlang, The Wolf Warrior, which actually was so successful it had a sequel, Janlang 2, The Wolf Warrior 2. They're basically kind of action and thriller movies from the 2010s about kind of Chinese crack armed squads that go into rescue frightened Chinese civilians in, you know, unnamed North African countries when the Western world can't help. And it's been used basically to describe, you know, sort of a kind of public attitude, particularly amongst diplomats, that sort of takes no prisoners, literally or metaphorically, you know, that basically China's out there, it's in the world, get used to it, guys. And it's generally confrontational, a little bit rude, a little bit, I don't care what you think, this is what I think attitude. So I would say that the strongest critiques that I have heard of wolf warrior style diplomacy have come from Chinese people, and actually specifically from Chinese diplomats, many of whom will say, often in private, sometimes in public, that actually they just really think this is not a good idea. I mean, you know, how does it help China to actually basically have its ambassadors to the world going out and basically having competitions on social media about who can be ruder to their hosts than anyone else? A certain number of European based Chinese ambassadors were, I think, competing with each other on those particular terms, particularly in parts of Central Europe. And actually, it's notable that if you look at some of the people who have been sent out recently in major diplomatic roles, a lot of them, including Xie Feng, who's going to Washington, these are generally people who are considered to be much more sort of mainstream, calm, diplomatic figures. So I think that there has been an internal pushback against that. I think, in answer to your question as to why it would happen, there's a lot of factors. But one, I think, has to do with COVID. COVID was a weird time for Chinese. It was a weird time for everybody, but it was a weird time for Chinese diplomacy. First of all, because China was very much on the back foot, because lots of countries around the world, and not just in the West, were asking China about, you know, what its connections were with COVID because of the outbreak. And China's diplomats and politicians took deep offense in many cases. And so, you know, they launched a sort of boycott of sorts against Australia, where the then Prime Minister Scott Morrison made a kind of query about this. And in other cases, they basically made it clear that, you know, this is not a subject they wanted to discuss. The problem was the rest of the world did want to discuss it at length, and therefore you ended up with diplomats who found that, for their point of view, the most useful thing to keep their position at home was to basically say, I'm not going to talk about this. I'm going to talk about something else instead. And it was almost like kind of loudly changing the subject and, you know, holding your hand over your ears to pretend you can't hear what anyone else is saying. And it worked for a short time in COVID because everything was, you know, nobody was talking to each other anyway. But it began to fall apart, really, when the world opened up, except for China. And then there was that sort of strange period between about 21, 22, when everywhere else was open again, you know, United States, Middle East, Europe, but China wasn't. And that meant that China's diplomats were even more isolated in a sense, because quite often they were having to stay in the embassy under orders from Beijing, and they couldn't be out and about in the societies where they needed to be out spreading their message. And I think finally it became very clear that actually diplomacy is very expensive. Maintaining a network of embassies around the world costs a lot of money. Paying for diplomats to go and live in foreign cities and spend, you know, years and years and years there is a huge undertaking. What on earth is the point of doing that and then keeping those people locked in a building somewhere in a capital city and basically doing nothing except sending out social media messages, which are mostly intended for people back at home in China. And I think once that set of realizations had come together, it was probably a bit of a kind of sharp intake of breath somewhere in Beijing, a decision, actually, let's go back to doing proper diplomacy. And there's been much more of a sense of that recently. The relationship with the United States is a bit exceptional because, of course, that's such a confrontational relationship anyway. But even there, there's some signs of conversation between the two sides. And with Europeans, it's really flipped the other way. And China has been reaching out extensively to the Germans, to the French, to the EU, elsewhere, even to the British, actually, recently, and trying to create a much, much more even frame for diplomatic negotiation. And you don't hear the term wolf warrior very much anymore.
So you mentioned that there is sort of a reversion to a more conventional foreign policy and a toning down of the assertiveness and perhaps even aggression of China on the world stage. Does this same change in attitude apply also to the issues of Taiwan and Hong Kong, do you think?
So you summarize my thought there very effectively, Wanlin, but I made an exception. I'm going to just say it again because it's really important. With the exception of the relationship with the United States, I think that that is something that is becoming very, very confrontational in many ways. And both sides are trying to calm it down, having said that. But I think the level of calming is still not nearly as significant as it has been, I think, for the Europeans. To some extent, actually, with Japan, although that's a slightly different issue. And certainly, you know, I think there's no question that at the moment, Chinese relations with sub-Saharan Africa, with Latin America and Southeast Asia, and actually with Australia, are at a calmer level than they were perhaps 2 or 3 years ago. So the US is almost kind of an exception now in terms of that wider spectrum of where China is seeking to place its diplomacy, since it was, you know, basically having a shouting fit at large parts of the world 2 years ago, and it's not doing that in quite such a way now. So the question of Taiwan and Hong Kong. My sense is that China is no longer entertaining any discussions on the question of Hong Kong. It has imposed, you know, through the National Security Law of 2020, a series of restrictions, particularly on the breadth of political argument that have essentially flipped the situation there. And international you know, complaints and pushback against this are essentially just, you know, not really being taken on board. The main argument that seems to be used now is that Hong Kong is open again for business, the world can come and do business, and that's really only, you know, question that China will take. Taiwan is different because, of course, it's now a much more active geopolitical crisis. And the problem is that, well, there's lots of problems, but one is that the United States and its allies, including Japan, South Korea and others, and China, have got themselves into a situation where there is a very unstable status quo, and both sides are blaming the other for essentially destabilizing the status quo. The difficulty is that the status quo itself is unstable because it relies on Taiwan being, as it has been since 1971 at the UN and 1979 with the United States, an unrecognized state entity in the world, but also the fact that it has developed into a highly consolidated liberal democracy, and that the question of how the democracy is preserved is something that Beijing doesn't really openly engage with at all. And the question of where Taiwan's status leaves the US acknowledgement of the so-called One China policy, which has essentially existed in some form really since the 1970s and the visit of President Nixon. These are almost like two different strands of argument that pass each other without ever crossing over in the middle.
So I know that you have mentioned that you hate doing predictions and you think historians should just stick to history.
I didn't say I hate doing them. I just say they're not very reliable. I do them all the time and they usually turn out to be wrong.
Yeah,
but I'm happy to have a go.
You can give the most informed prediction today. So maybe to sum up this segment, could you give us a answer to where do you see China flexing its powers next, or what is in its future in terms of international relations?
I think that in the near future, by which I mean certainly the next couple of years, which is perhaps as much as responsible really to look forward to, I don't see huge change. Because in lots of areas, including China's growing strength in international organizations, and in lots of areas where China has reached, I think, a comfortable consensus and doesn't want to revisit it, such as climate change, China doesn't see a huge amount of advantage in changing what's happening now. And I think the likelihood of a confrontation over any issue concerning the United States is probably low in the next year or two. The reason being that I suspect that a lot of people in Beijing are waiting to see what happens in the next US presidential election and then to make their calculations accordingly as to who the president is, because the continuation of a Biden administration might lead to a rather different set of outcomes from a Republican administration headed by a relatively isolationist figure. That could be Donald Trump, it could be Ron DeSantis. I don't, use the word isolationist in anything other than analytical terms here, on the grounds that they have so far shown less interest in the idea of American projection of power into the world than either Republicans or Democrats have tended to do up to the early 2010s. And I think Beijing's very aware of that and wants to work out what its own best results would be coming off the back of that.
Right. So I guess that's as good as a prediction as we can make at this point.
Well, the prediction is basically for not much change, other than lots of sort of, people on all sides will continue to raise their voices and get angry about particular issues. But barring some perhaps unexpected confrontation, perhaps, and that could always happen, it doesn't seem to me that in the short, immediate term, that will be too likely.
Well, thank you very much. If we could just spend maybe the last 5 minutes
Sure.
delving a little bit into your personal career, because we know that a lot of our audience are, aspiring academics or people who want to go into international development.
Sure.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about your journey, how you got into academia, what inspired you.
Sure. Sure, absolutely. Well, I have to, in good Confucian Xiao style, give a lot of credit to my parents, who both are academics or were academics. And I suspect that even though I probably spent a lot of childhood thinking I want to do something different, I ended up in the end, I think, being influenced by environment in certain ways. So they don't work on China. But I would say that overall, my decision to study Chinese a very long time ago and start with, Chinese language, was a slightly out of the way one in terms of my context, which was growing up in the southeast of England in the 80s and 90s, when China wasn't very much on anyone's agenda. So there certainly was no foresight on my part that this was going to be a major subject. And the reason I say that is that it's sometimes, some things should be pre-planned in life, but you can't plan everything in life. And I think in this particular case, getting onto a subject that would turn out to have, quite a lot of global significance was not something that I would have expected. And beyond that, I think having studied Chinese and learned more about the kind of context of modern history and society, it made me realize that there was an awful lot more that really could be discovered. Compared, say, to fields like, British history, American history, where a lot of topics are really very, very well covered. There's always new things to discover, but more of the ground has been covered there. But for Westerners in particular, there's still tremendous numbers of things that remain to be known and discovered in the context of Chinese history. So that drew me very much into that path. And then that also ended up over time sort of leading me to the next phase, which was being a historian who spends quite a lot of time thinking about the present day, because I think I came to realize that in China, perhaps more than any other country I can think of, understanding China's past, both relatively recent history, say the last 100 years, 150 years, which is my own area of specialization, and the longer past, including the philosophical traditions that come from, 2,500 years and before, are important not because history repeats itself or because every Chinese thinker is necessarily a great expert on pre-modern philosophy. Yeah, no one would claim that. But understanding the wider context that shapes understandings and assumptions in Chinese policy making can't be done without some significant knowledge of the history. And in fact, the course that I'm going to be teaching from this autumn, as I move jobs from Oxford to Harvard, is actually specifically for policymakers, but it's a history course. It's about Chinese modern history in particular, and how certain case studies can help you to understand things that China's doing in the contemporary world in one way or another. So I would like to think that having started with a study of elements such as language and history, which often are thought of by people as, being in some ways almost marginal to a kind of central study of policy decisions, that in fact they are actually very central to understanding very contemporary issues that have to do with everything from why, you know, the Chinese, I mean, you can't understand why the Chinese economy is doing what it does unless you understand what Chinese society is like. And, you know, that's something that involves historical and social knowledge. And similarly, the international relations of China are of relevance to everyone on earth today, but they can't possibly be understood without understanding how China's international relations were very different 50, 100 and 500 years ago. So that really, I think, was what drew me through those particular phases, you know, language and then history and then contemporary analysis. But the contemporary analysis came last, not first. And I think I'm quite glad that I went in that direction.
So would you be focusing a lot on, you mentioned marginalized voices and intellectual history in your new phase of your career?
I would hope so. I mean, one of the, if we're talking about marginalized voices, the research project we're doing at the moment, which is on the late 1940s in China, is of course about a historical period, but it's a historical period that I think has huge echoes for the present day. And one particular set of documents that I'm reading at the moment that I found fascinating is the diaries of young women who joined the communist revolution in the late 1940s. They're aged probably not much older than you, actually, one in the kind of early 20s, 22, 23, and their lives at some level look very familiar to anyone in the present day. You know, they're worrying about their families, they're worrying about, you know, their own appearances, they're worrying about whether they're going to get married, all these sorts of things. But they're also learning the contours, the framework of a revolutionary time, a time when absolutely everything they assumed and knew about society has been overturned. And I think understanding quite how transformative that kind of change is in China is huge. I think it's particularly important, actually, in Western countries, liberal countries, because certainly since 1945, it's been unusual to find Western European countries, Eastern Europe is different, but Western European countries that have gone through that kind of genuinely revolutionary experience. And in that sense, understanding how disruption shapes human lives is one of the best ways, I think, to understand history from below. And that would certainly include, you know, as I say, for me, reading the writings of a 23-year-old revolutionary woman is perhaps more revealing than reading the works of Chairman Mao in some ways. More entertaining too, in some ways.
That's an incredible sentiment. And with that, we unfortunately have to wrap up this episode. Thank you so much, Rana, for joining us and taking time out of your incredibly busy schedule. And we wish you all the best in your next step towards Harvard, returning to, in some ways, to your alma mater.
In a sense, yes, at least I've spent time there before and looking forward to it again, but I shall still be connected to Oxford and certainly have enjoyed, you know, decades of training some of the most wonderful students who've gone on to do great things. So thank you, Wanlin, for this invitation, and thanks to everyone on this Oxid audience, and look forward to being in conversation in some form or another in future as well.
Thank you so much. This has been China and the World with Rana Mitter. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Goodbye.